Some dogs have bad experiences, but they take them in stride. Other dogs have bad experiences, and they don't take them in stride. Today, we're going to take a look at why that is the case and what you and I can do to make dogs more resilient. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Really pleased to welcome back Patricia McConnell, certified applied animal behaviorist, international speaker, author, co-hosted Calling All Pets with me for 14 years. Oh my goodness. Her latest book is The Education of Will, Healing a Dog, Facing My Fears, Reclaiming My Life. Has your dog been traumatized? What questions do you have about helping your dog become more resilient, perhaps? Love to hear from you. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Always love to see photos of you and your pet. And Patricia, welcome back.
Oh, it's fun to be here, Larry.
Resilience in dogs. Mm-hmm. What is a resilient dog like? Or what is resiliency in dogs?
Let's just talk about resiliency.
Yeah, okay.
Period, first, right?
Sure.
Because it's really through humans that we first learned about this concept. And it's we all really know what it is. It's like a rubber band, you know? If you stretch it out, then it stretches itself back. Or not, right?
Yeah.
Or an old one that's brittle and it breaks. And if you think about it, every system we have in our bodies needs resilience. So, and every system in our bodies has a comfort zone. So you have sort of a normal temperature, and you can have a temperature of 101, and then you can bounce back to your normal 98.6. If you go too far, it gets harder and harder, right? As your temperature gets higher and higher, there's more potential damage, and it gets harder to come back. And so, you know, so we have these comfort zones of temperature, of calcium, potassium balance, but we also have psychological comfort zones. And they're also biochemical because they depend on how your brain is functioning.
Yeah.
And structures within your brain and sort of biochemical, physiological reactions. But so we also have this mental psychological comfort zone. And say something really distressful happens, you know, whether you're in a car accident. Say you're in a car accident.
Yeah.
Even if you're not badly, badly hurt. That can be very, very traumatic and stressful, you know,
absolutely,
depending on certain factors, right? As a matter of fact, I learned when writing The Education of Will that a third of people in serious car accidents develop PTSD for a certain amount of time, especially if it happens out of the blue. And that's classic for PTSD. If you don't see it coming, it can be even more distressing because your brain learns you never know, right?
Yeah.
You never know what's going to happen. So resilience is being able to go through something difficult and recover from it. The opposite of resilience, in a way, and I'm sort of stretching things here.
Right.
This is not a medical definition, but in a way you can think of PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder as a loss of resilience. Because basically what happens is the center of fear in your brain, the amygdala, and the hippocampus that's associated with emotional memories, they literally change their function. So the amygdala becomes more active. Basically the brain is always on panic mode. And I know what that feels like. I'm going to write about that in The Education. Well, I know exactly what that feels like. And so circling back to dogs, Larry, there is very, very strong evidence that dogs can be psychologically traumatized. Some people talk about PTSD in dogs. I'm not comfortable doing that from a kind of a strict definition perspective, because one of the three factors that are required to diagnose PTSD in a person is that is something that has to be expressed verbally. So do you have flashbacks? You know, do you have frightening thoughts? I mean, for years, I imagined a man behind me about to smash my head in with a baseball bat.
Yeah.
That came out of nowhere, right?
Yeah.
You can't ask dogs that, right? So we can't say for sure that they have the exact equivalent of human PTSD, but in a way it doesn't matter because we know that they can be psychologically traumatized. And I've seen so many dogs, Larry, who were, quote, aggressive.
Yeah.
which is often an overly active amygdala, or very fearful or shut down, who, as we work back with the clients talking about what happened in the past, clearly had been traumatized and hadn't found a way out of it and had lost that resiliency.
Can you bring that back? I mean, how does it start with a dog? Is a dog pretty much resilient and
perfect? That's the perfect next place to go.
Yeah.
This is why we work together so well. Mila, you just live in my brain. It's so fun to be back with you. So here's what we know about resiliency is there are three factors that go into it. One is genetics. So The way your brain functions, you know, how active your amygdala is, how quick it is to tell your adrenal glands to release adrenaline, that has a genetic component. And there's no question about it in humans. There's a very strong genetic component too. In dogs, if you look at a lot of the working dogs, guide dogs for the blind, for example,
mm-hmm.
they have been breeding dogs that are that we call bomb-proof. Now, ironically, that there's so many dogs working in war zones that literally have to be bomb-proof in terms of at least coping with all that noise or the potential noise of an explosion around them. So Guide Dogs for the Blind has been breeding for years dogs who are super resilient and really stable, just super, super mellow. And we know that with people. I mean, don't you know people who are just...
Yeah.
They're just so even-keeled, right?
Yeah.
I'm not. That's so not me. But there's a very strong genetic component to it in both dogs and people. And then early development plays a huge role because the brain is still being formed in utero and after birth, both, again, in dogs and people. So what happens in utero, we know, has a big effect. There was research actually from some people here in UW-Madison that found that if you just expose monkey moms while they were pregnant to some aversive noise, it wasn't torturous at all. It was just sort of a loud noise. It was, you know,
bang or something.
Yeah, it was like 100 plus decibels for 10 seconds, but it was random. They didn't know what was going to happen. They compared their young with those of control mothers who weren't exposed to those noises at a certain time of their pregnancy. And even a year after birth, the young behaved differently.
Wow.
The young who were exposed to those noise stresses were less able to cope with novel environments, more easily stressed and distressed. So early environment, including in utero, but also after birth, has a profound effect. So dogs, for example, who've been raised in a completely sterile environment where there's never exposure to any change or any kind of a moderate stress. There's this phenomena called hormesis, H-O-R, hormesis. It sounds like a disease to me.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, Larry, are you recovering from your hormesis? I'm so sorry. But it's the Goldilocks phenomenon, basically, is a little bit of stress in early development is really good because it helps set your system. So early development is important. And then, of course, current sort of adult history experience, kind of support group you have, how you've learned to cope with traumas and stress, those are all really important. So those are important with both dogs and people. And circling back to your first question, yes, you can help. You can redevelop resistance once it's been lost. You might never get quite to where you would have been before, but you can have a profound effect on a dog who's been traumatized in a very good way.
Wow. Patricia McConnell, our guest today, is certified applied animal behaviorist, author of, she's author of many books. The latest is The Education of Will, a mutual memoir of a woman and her dog, just out in paperback now.
It is, yeah.
It's a hardcover to paperback.
Yeah, yeah. It has a new cover, and I love the cover.
Yeah, it's a pretty... And I know that place.
He does. It's actually a photograph I took. Maybe you could put it up on your Facebook page or something. But
yeah.
It's I say that like, you know, some magical gremlin will do that instantly. But yeah, it's a picture of a dog working sheep silhouetted by a big sky up on the hill behind my farmhouse.
Yeah,
Larry has
beautiful.
Indeed been there. You've even worked sheep up there, right?
I
You've
have.
Worked dogs.
with you right next to me helping me along. Well, I tell you, what was I going to say here? You mentioned dogs that work with the blind or dogs that, you know, service dogs. And you were telling me before the show that those dogs often have a high amount of stress in many ways, do they not?
There's so many kinds of working dogs now. You know, the field has exploded from dogs that sniff out cancer to dogs who are bomb detection dogs to dogs who are search and rescue dogs to guide dogs for people with disabilities. So yeah, there's a huge range. And I'm actually going to be giving a keynote speech in Philadelphia for a working dog conference, and one of the first things I'm going to say is each field has to define what the difficulty is, what the stressors are, what the potential trauma is. It's obviously very different for a dog who's a guide dog, for somebody who's sight impaired, versus a search and rescue dog.
A dog that's sniffing out bombs in a military action or something.
Right. Or, I just talked to Steve White, who's one of the country's best trainers of police dogs. So he's at the top of his field. He uses positive reinforcement. He's just fantastic. Mm. But he was telling me about, on his watch, there were two police dogs, each of whom was shot while on duty.
Yeah.
By someone who was trying to kill them. One dog, they were both injured badly, somewhat equally, not exactly the same, but somewhat equally, and one bounced back and went right back to duty, and the other could never work again. Oh. So again, there's so many factors that can go into this.
Well, we have every one of our lines filled. Let's see. Ray and Rhinelander, I think, is up first. Hi, Ray.
Hi. Patricia, thank you very much for writing that book. It's fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
And I was wondering if you ever heard of or knew of people who did any research on that famous dog from Japan called Hitachi?
Yes, yes.
And how he waited day after day, month after month, for his owner to come by, and people were taking care of him, and they'd come up to him. Have you checked that out, and would that be to any relationship to the resilience of a dog putting up with something? I mean, it had to have been traumatic, but he hung in there. And would you like to comment on that?
Sure, and that was the master died, the dog's owner died.
The master, this is the dog at the train station, I think, is the one we're talking about. There are several examples of that, by the way. But there's one out west somewhere in the States. But there are several examples of dogs whose master never came back, never came out of the train, and just use that as an example. So first of all, I should answer your first question, Ray, is have I checked that out? No, I can't attest to exactly how accurate some of that is. So some of it might be stories, some of it, based on accuracy. But there are enough stories of dogs like that they're credible, at least the big picture is credible, and that a dog will wait day after day. And so there's sort of the sweet sentimental part, which is a dog goes back to the train station every day or waits at the train station for its owner to get off the train, never leaves. Eventually, people start feeding it, taking care of it. There's actually one of the cases was the station master actually took in the dog, started sleeping in his office at night, and basically became his dog. But the dog was still always waited for the 3:43 train or, whatever it was. So sentimentally, we're all thinking, and I certainly want to buy into this, that the dog is waiting for its master. Less sentimental is the best way I can come up with right now, objective perspective, which is the dog basically just had a habit, right? Yeah. It just had a habit of waiting for the train, and it just sort of kept in the train. Did it still have its master in its mind 5 years later? We don't know. But there are, I will say to Ray and everybody thinking about this, there are so many cases, and I've had clients whose dogs, the hardest one was there was a golden and the little boy died. It was a little seven, eight-year-old boy, and he died, and he never came home from school, and the dog waited at the window, and by the time they came to me, he'd been waiting in distress at the window for like 6 or 7 months or something. Now I made myself cough. I got so upset. But so there are many cases of dogs who indeed have waited for a loved one. And, you know, of course dogs can love people or other dogs. And so you know, there is a lot to that. Absolutely.
And so does that relate to resilience in any way, or is it?
Well, that's a really good question. Does that relate to resilience? Yes and no. Because usually what people are talking about with resilience is not so much, yes and no. So the yes part is you would think a perfectly resilient individual would be able to move on eventually, right? Would be able to get over grieving and then move on. You know, we think about that with people whose spouses have died, for example. You would think about the same thing with a dog. The no part, I could see somebody arguing that usually when you talk about resilience, you're talking about recovering from trauma. And usually that's a kind of a more acute event. So I can see, I'm sort of in the middle. I would say yes and no. There we are.
Yeah.
There we go.
Well, maybe the owner not coming home is an acute event for the dog.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it certainly is when we lose somebody we love, you know, very, very much. So, yeah, in that sense, yes, absolutely.
Patricia McConnell, our guest today, a certified applied animal behaviorist, author of many books, including her latest, The Education of Will, A Mutual Memoir of a Woman and Her Dog. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at resilience and our dogs today with our guest, Patricia McConnell. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us so much today on the Ideas Network. Questions or experiences for you to share with us, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Mike in Appleton, let's give you a chance. Hi, Mike. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks for having me. Basically, I'm just calling today because, I mean, I was just kind of flipping through the radio stations, and it kind of interested me a little bit because, actually, I served 4 years in the Marine Corps, and our platoon was stationed with a dog handler and a bomb-sniffing dog.
Yeah.
And he was with us the entire deployment, the entire 8 months, and you know, there were points where if we weren't dodging bullets, you know, getting ambushed, you know, the dog was dealing with, you know, dogs that were, you know, over there and that were aggressive and that would try to, you know, attack him and stuff. And it seemed like by the end of the deployment, you know, his reaction to everything had changed, like, dramatically to the point where he would be lashing out and constantly barking his, you know, I can't really explain it, but I mean, I knew the dog for close to a year and a half and had, you know, trained up to the point where, you know, before he went on deployment with us. So I guess my question is, what are the studies specifically on military service dogs, and how would rehabilitation, like, what would that look like?
Yeah. Oh. Thanks a lot, Mike, for calling.
Yeah, thank you so much, and adding your experience to this conversation, because it's so vital and it's so important. I have never read a study, but I've talked to some of the people who train dogs, the very dogs who like the dog you work with, and the estimate is about 10% of the dogs who've been in war zones come back with PTSD, and that what you're describing is heartbreaking. To anybody who loves humans or dogs, because that kind of constant assault, I mean, you were dodging bullets, you were probably also very worried about never knowing when you were going to be attacked by your own species. Mm-hmm. Here the dog was being attacked by other dogs, or like could always be. So the estimate is about 10% of dogs who come back from that kind of service do indeed come back with PTSD. Mm. Some of them can indeed be rehabilitated, and some of them can't. Some of them are retired. I wish You know, if the world was ideal, that dog would have been taken out of service way sooner than it had been. Things are way better for military dogs now. I mean, I think everybody knows the tragedies of the dogs who were never brought back from Vietnam. So things are way better now. They're taking much better care of the dogs. They're bringing them back. They're trying to rehabilitate them or finding new homes. But, you know, my heart goes out to everybody in that situation, humans and dogs. But, yeah, so that dog... I would guess that dog, after 8 months of that, given what you describe, could have probably been rehabilitated to be a companion dog, but not a working dog.
Not a working dog.
Not in that situation,
Mike, thanks again
for
calling.
Yeah, thank you so much, Mike.
Ruth in Altoona will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Ruth.
How are you? I just have a question about, certainly there's the taking care of the dog, the all the other aspects of looking at how do you help them with anxiety and other things.
Mm-hmm.
But what are your thoughts on CBD oil? Because that's kind of the new hot topic these days. Or, you know, what are your thoughts about that? And also it's... recommended for older dogs with arthritis. There are probably other things too, but I just was interested in your take.
Yeah, good question. And for people who don't know, this is an oil derived from the active ingredients of marijuana. And so my take on it is I don't know. I feel very cautious, very, very cautious. You know, I'm always not quick to jump on the hot new thing. I don't know, I'm a Midwesterner maybe.
I know exactly what you mean.
I tend to be pretty conservative about things we just don't know that much about. You know, I'm conservative about Western medicine, but I'm conservative about all kinds of alternative adjunctive medicine too. I use it all, but I'm also very conservative about it. And so I just haven't seen enough studies. I know it's a hot topic. People are talking about it. Medication drug that people are talking about to try and actually prevent PTSD after a trauma, both in people and dogs, is ecstasy, is MMDA. There is some research that finds that the careful administration of that can alleviate the potential of PTSD. PTSD really is interesting biologically because it doesn't happen instantly. It actually takes some time to develop. What happens is the brain literally starts changing. And usually, I mean, I would see dogs, I can't tell you how many clients' dogs I saw like this. They would come in, they had originally been really, really friendly dogs. They loved everybody, they loved other dogs. And then they went to the dog park one day where they'd always had a good time. And they growled at all the black dogs, or all the golden retrievers, and then it started growling at all the golden retrievers and Labradors, and eventually it was attacking every dog it saw, or barking and lunging. And we'd walk it back, and we'd be like, "Oh, wait! 3 weeks before the first growl, another dog jumped him at the gate as we were walking into the dog park. And he was really badly hurt, but he was really, really scared. And then the next time we went back to the park, he was fine. But the time after, he wasn't. And that's really typical. So if you can stop this from happening, if you can stop this cycle, this physiological cycle sometimes, then you can, it seems as though from some of the research on humans, and I know some veterinarians are trying it on dogs, you can stop it. But so I'm conservative about that. I'm conservative about CBD oil. I await seeing more studies.
Yeah, makes good sense. Ruth, thank you so much for calling.
It was a great question. Thanks for asking, Ruth.
You know, I think this probably maybe a good time to talk about your latest book, The Education of Will. A mutual memoir of a woman and her dog, just out in paperback. Because here we have a case of PTSD, or cases, and resilience. So maybe give our listeners, tell the basic story there.
Sure, yeah. For people who don't know it, people who know me know I've been writing about dogs and dog behavior for years and years. And about, gosh, he's 11 and a half now, so a little over 11 years ago, this adorable little border collie puppy, Willie, came to me as if he'd been the dog who came back from Afghanistan. He was terrified of other dogs. He was super sound reactive, so a butterfly could, flap its wings in China, and he was... And I had a series of traumas when I was younger. I was violently raped. I had a man die in front of me, just literally fall five stories pretty much from the sky and die 5 feet in front of me. And several other incidents, one of which isn't even in the book because the editors were like, that's too horrible, take it out. So I thought I was good. I mean, I thought I was healed, right? I'd been to therapist. I'd worked on it. I thought it was good. But this little reactive, panicky puppy ended up setting me back. You know how we think of dogs as being great therapists? He was the anti-therapist.
Just the opposite.
All of my symptoms came back. And I'd never gotten rid of all of them. I just managed, like most of
them. Learn to control.
Yeah, and many of us do. We just manage it, you know. I've traveled all over the world giving seminars that I think nobody knew. I would go into my hotel room and lock the door and stay there, mm-hmm. you know, when I was done. And I was afraid to walk in the barn if there wasn't a light on. And I was afraid to go up in my own bedroom. And I just managed it and I cope with it. So I got worse. And so he forced me, bless him, he forced me to deal with it at a whole deeper level. So the book is about me and Willie on our path to recovery. I realized at one point that in order to heal Willie, I was going to have to go deeper to heal myself. So that's what the book is about. It ends up with me and Willie in really good places.
Yeah.
So it's a very happy book, but it does have, you know, I described some of the traumas, and that's, you know, yeah. what it is.
That's
and
what it is. What
it's
it
very
is.
Timely. I'm appalled and thrilled with what's going on socially with the Me Too movement. I'm yeah. appalled because it's so necessary. You know, when the whole Weinstein thing came out, Larry, I was talking to Jim, my husband, and I just turned to him and I said, welcome to our world. Welcome to the yeah. world of being a woman.
You know? Yeah.
It's like, this is what it's like for many, many of us. And it's just so inspiring to see, especially young people, both men and women. And by the way, men are sexually assaulted often, too. It's really important to keep that in mind. Many people have come up to me on book tour and said, thank you for writing this book. You know, as a man, I was raped or I was assaulted. So we need to make sure this is about sexual assault, not just men and women. But
well, Barbara in Middleton emailed to say your latest book is heartrending. Your research and knowledge endless. Thank you for a wonderful and touching story.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so yeah. much. And so that feels so good to hear. I did spend 5.5 years writing that book. It did take a while.
Well, given all that happened to you, I can understand why it might take 5 years.
Yeah, the first part was really therapy. I actually started as therapy. I wasn't going to write a book. I wasn't going to publish it. And then after a while, it sort of grew and became something else. Yeah. So thank you.
Well, let's take some more calls. Rich in Two Rivers, I think it's your turn. Thanks for calling, Rich.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I just got a beautiful golden doodle. I had her since 8 weeks, and she's turned 13 on Friday, and I put her in I had to board her because I was trout fishing down in southeast Minnesota this weekend. And she did really good. She's a wonderful dog. She's super smart. My question is, what does it take paperwork-wise to the medical field to have a dog become a service dog? Because, I mean, my son did it. He lives in San Francisco. And they're able to take their golden doodle to, you know, in the plane with them and everything else. And I just... I'm meeting with a psychiatrist. I suffered from depression last year, yeah. and I got over it. I feel good, and I wouldn't have a dog if I was depressed. That's why I felt the time was right. But do you know what steps you have to take?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes and no. I can tell you some generalities, probably not as much detail as you want because I'm not a specialist in this field. But for one thing, there are two kinds of dogs that we could be thinking, that you could be thinking about for you. One is a service dog, and service dogs are defined very, very precisely. So service dogs are dogs who act, who do things, who add an action in order to help somebody. So, for example, a hearing aid dog is going to alert somebody when the phone rings. Obviously, guide dog for the blind is going to pick up something that's dropped and, you know, give it to their owner. Wheelchair assistance dogs help people up ramps, help push the button on the elevator, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera. Psychiatric service dogs are dogs who alert their owners when their owner starts to go into a bad place. And I've known some of these dogs, and they really can be miraculous because there's a man named Richard Rice who's now in Germany, but he's an American serviceman who was profoundly traumatized. I won't even tell you what happened to him. It's traumatizing just hearing it, frankly. And he literally couldn't leave his home for over 2 years. His wife basically said, you either get fixed or, you know, I cannot live like this with you anymore. He was dangerous. He was extremely aggressive. He ended up with Molly. He ended up with an amazing black Labrador who helped basically let him feel like she was on alert. So she was scanning the environment for him. And if he started to get too nervous, his blood pressure increased, his breathing increased, she probably could smell fear, you know, we don't know about that, but she would alert him and she would get him out of the situation. Or if somebody was coming too fast towards him, she would bark at that person basically to say, stop, you're getting too close to Richard. And so Richard could count on her. So that was a service dog. So she was actively trained to intervene. Now there are also emotional support dogs. Emotional support dogs don't have to do anything except be polite in public, right?
Yeah.
Unlike the peacock, emotional support peacock, who somebody now famously tried to get on an airplane, it's hard to train peacocks to be polite on a plane. So emotional support dogs don't have to be trained to do any action. They are there to be support for you. And there are different rules about where each type of dog can go, and I am so sorry, Rich, I'm not up enough. I should be, but I'm not up enough to tell you exactly what situations emotional support dogs can go. You can get, there's some, frankly, some sort of shady certificates you could get online. Please don't get those. They're polluting the world for people who really, really do need these dogs. Most dogs on planes, you'd need some kind of a letter from a medical professional, from a psychiatrist or an internist, some kind of a medical doctor or a PhD psychologist who basically says, this person needs this dog in order to function. So part of it depends on what you need the dog to do. Part of it depends on what you want to be able to do with the dog. So that's general, but I hope that was helpful.
Yeah.
Very helpful. Thank you.
Oh, good.
Thank you very
much.
Yeah, good luck, Rich. Thank you for calling. And let's take another call. Paula in Austin, Texas. Your turn now. Hi, Paula.
Hi. I would like to know if Dr. McConnell can address how to build resiliency in our dogs.
Oh, yeah. Just let me at it. I'm just giving a speech on that on Friday. So I'm just, thank you for asking that. Well, first of all, genetics. So obviously you can't go backwards, you know, if you already have a dog. But again, there is a very strong genetic component to it. So that's one thing to know. So if you're picking out a dog, one thing you want to ask about in terms of their parents and other grandparents, aunts and uncles. It's important to look beyond the parents, by the way. You know, genetics just don't work that way. You need to look at a bigger family history. But a lot of people never ask these questions. You know, what happened after the dog was attacked by another dog? Or, you know, has there been a situation in which the dog was terrified? How was the dog in thunderstorms? You know, see if you can get some handle on how resilient the parents are. So that's one. If you have the potential for effect during early development, you're in a great position. I'm actually going to go visit and stay with a friend and a colleague in Philadelphia, Meg Boskoff of Pup Up Social Learning, who works with autistic children. They are purpose breeding a litter of Cavalier King Charles Spaniels in order to work with autistic children. These dogs need to be very resilient. And so one of the things they will be doing very, very soon is working through a program called Puppy Culture by Joan Killian. Puppy Culture, it's a great DVD. by Joan Killian, and she walks people through the developmental stages of early development, puppies basically from about, well, from birth to about 12 weeks, and all of the things you can do to help a puppy learn and grow to be more resilient. And again, it's that hormesis word, that's a little bit of stress at the right time, builds resilience. You don't want no stress. You don't want too much stress. It's sort of the Goldilocks effect. And then once you have a dog, say you have a dog who's 5 months old or 3 years old, the way you can help build resilience is, one, is basically you look at human psychological research, is because it's the same, is you need an animal needs a secure attachment base. So you have to create a secure attachment base. I am Maggie, and I am Maggie's secure attachment base. My husband Jim is Willie's attachment base, because Jim is the one who's more resilient. Willie and I are too much alike, right? We both love Jim because he's, you know, the oak tree, and, you know, we're like little aspens fluttering in the wind, you know? So they need a secure attachment base. Sometimes it's another dog, sometimes it's a person, sometimes it's a community of people. And they need a certain amount of agency, as people in human psychology call it. They need a certain amount of autonomy. They know that they have some control over their life, and a lot of dogs have almost no control over their life right now. So you can do that by training dogs tricks and then asking them to sort of do one to get what they want. You know, you want a treat, you can do this. You can let them decide where to go on a walk, which way do you, we could have a cue. I have a cue that's like, where do you want to go?
No.
You know, where do you want to go? Which way? You don't always have to decide which way to go. You can let them sniff at their own pace on a walk if they have to be on a leash. You can let them be free if they can be safe off a leash. That gives dogs autonomy. So those are probably the two most important things. And then letting them know that you will protect them. Letting them not feel like they're going to be attacked by another dog because you're going to let that happen, right? So having them have a sense of the world is a relatively safe and secure place.
Yeah, all good points. Paula, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Patricia McConnell, our guest today, certified applied animal behaviorist, author of many books, including The Education of Will, just out in paperback, a mutual memoir of a woman and her dog. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Really pleased to welcome back Patricia McConnell. She is talking with us today about our dogs and about resilience in our dogs. We're talking a little bit about PTSD and how it might relate to resilience, and certainly taking your questions, comments, and maybe some experiences as well that you may have had or a friend or relative may have had with a dog. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's take another call. Carrie in Hammond, it is your turn. Carrie, thank you for calling.
Thank you. My dog has bit me 3 times, and I've had him since Christmas Eve. Ooh. He's about a year, I don't think he's probably about a year and a half, black lab old, and we are at least his third home.
Okay.
And the first time I was trying to take a toy away because he was ripping it up. The second time, I was by his dish purposely there, petting him and stuff, and he growled. Then he did more than growl. And the other time was just a Saturday night. I put my hand out to tell him goodbye because we were going to go down to the neighbors for a little bit. And he was chewing on his bone, and he, with no warning, grabbed my hand. He has drawn blood 3 times.
Oh, I'm so sorry, first of all. Let me just say that. Bad news is, I don't need to tell you the bad news. The bad news is he's bitten 3 times in a very, very short period of time. And he's a relatively young dog, so that's sort of good and bad news.
Mm-hmm.
The good part is that he is young, and that makes him a little bit more receptive potential to conditioning. The best news, if you can say there's good news and and a dog who's bitten three times, is it's all been in the same context. And one of the factors you look at in terms of success of treatment is how predictable is it? Because the more unpredictable it is, then the harder it is to know you've got a handle on it, right?
Yeah.
The harder it is to know to manage it, to try and treat it. And the more context in which it happens, the more difficult it is. So, I mean, I've seen clients whose dogs bit owners, bit strangers, bit other dogs, but, you know, just that's really difficult because you basically have something happening in every possible realm of life. So the fact that it's all based on possession, right? You know, this is called resource guarding. So this dog is basically saying, stay away from my stuff. It's not always the easiest thing to turn around, I have to say. Some dogs turn around really nicely, other dogs don't. Let me ask you a few more questions, if I may. Do you mind telling me how serious the bites were?
I didn't have to go get stitches.
Okay.
But there was a, actually the first two times he bit me, it happened so fast. I was walking out to my daughter's kitchen and there's blood dripping.
And
bit me, you know.
Okay.
I was a little of shock. That time I did hit him twice until he cowered.
Okay.
But I never touched him. The second time I pinched his nose.
Okay. And the third time, did he hang on?
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay. So this, you know, somebody said once that all bites are the same. Well, that's just crazy if you're the bite recipient. I mean, it's like, no, they're not. I mean, I've had dogs who bit and sucked their teeth up to their gums and hang on and shook. You know, that's really different. So these were serious, obviously, and the dog is puncturing your skin, you're bleeding. These are very serious bites. I don't mean you shouldn't take them seriously. But at least they're not, you know, at least the dog isn't completely sort of losing himself. There was another question I was going to ask you, and I have absolutely no idea what it is. maybe it'll come to me. Let me tell you about, I know, now I thought about what it was. You may or may not be able to answer this question, okay? Don't worry if you can't. But sometimes when dogs bite you, you mentioned it just happened really, really fast. And by the way, just parenthetically, to all the people who say, I'm watching my dog with a two-year-old. No,
you're not.
You know, if anything happens, I can intervene. No, you can't. What people usually say, and this has happened to me when I was working, when I was seeing clients, is what people say is, I was bitten. You don't even know what happened till it's over. They're so fast. They are so much faster than we are. We don't even see it happen. They're that fast. You know, it's like that joke of want to see me do this, you know, want to see me draw my gun, want to see me do it again, right? So did you happen to see the dog's eyes change and go what people call hard? There's a hard eye that doesn't make any sense until you see it. And once you see it, you instantly know what everybody's talking about. Was there a moment where the dog went still and stiff and his eyes changed and got sort of hard and glassy? Or was it just like bang out of the blue?
It was bang out of the blue, but he is no dummy. He can open up his own crate door and go in and get his bone and bring it back out by using his paw and his mouth. He has let me know when it's time. He doesn't want to be in his cage, and he can be trusted, and that became very true.
He
looked at me and said, Ma, I don't want to go in there. You can trust me, and I did, and everything was fine.
Okay, so here you have a couple of options. The first one I would do if there's any way you can. Let's see, you're in Hammond. I don't know where Hammond is. I should. Where's Hammond?
Well, we're kind of in between Eau Claire and the cities.
Okay. So there's potential good help for you to get a progressive trainer or an animal behaviorist. The best thing you could do would be to have somebody come in and do a house call. You can go to the Association of Professional Dog Trainers. Go to their
website.
Google it. Go to their website. See if you can find a certified trainer in your area. I don't know of it. There's probably an animal behaviorist in Minneapolis. It's a possibility. That would be absolutely the best thing to do.
Could be in Eau Claire, too.
There's a book that it's titled Mine, M-I-N-E! that goes through a counter conditioning procedure to basically teach dogs how to feel differently when you approach one of their resources or their objects. It's written by Gene Donaldson. It's extensive. Some of my clients have been put off by it because it's very detailed. But it's a great resource. So you can find that online as well. In general, Carrie, what we're talking about here is a conditioning program where you teach your dog, rather than if she comes near my stuff, I'm going to lose it. I have to protect it. You're going to restructure his brain, including his amygdala, by the way. Speaking of amygdalas and PTSD, mm-hmm. I'm not saying he has that, but he has a very active amygdala, which is like on, no, you know, no, get away from that, right? What you want to do is condition him so that when you approach one of his resources, his treasures, his objects, he's like, oh boy, she's coming towards me. I'm going to get something better. So you start by, you know, give him some sort of medium quality resource. Nobody else is around. You're totally safe. You have pieces of chicken or something in your hand. You take one step towards him, you throw the chicken, and then you back away. And then you take another step towards and you throw the chicken and you back away. So what you're trying to do is condition him is that when she walks towards me, I get something even better than what I have. And then gradually over time, and this is why I suggest you get a trainer in to help you, gradually over time, you decrease the distance. You raise your hand, then you stretch your hand 6 inches, then you stretch your hand towards them 12 inches, but you do it in a very carefully controlled, thought out, systematic way. And you're always watching him to see how he reacts. So basically, I don't want you to go forward one step until the dog is like, oh, wow, hi, you know, all loose and squiggly. So these dogs can sometimes be turned around. Sometimes it can take quite a bit of work. I would always worry about a dog like this around young children. So I hope, you know, so I would always, if you could manage the dog, then I would certainly give it a try if you could manage it and get somebody to help you.
Good luck. Thank you so much for calling, Carrie. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Kelly in Mineral Point next. Kelly, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi.
Hi.
What can we do for you today?
Well, I have a almost 2-year-old American bulldog. He's really friendly. He's been bit by other dogs, but he never bites back.
Oh, resilience. Good boy.
Yeah. And now I rescued a dog, and he play bites, and he doesn't stop. Mm. And my dog doesn't like it. I've had him for a week now, and my dog, Diesel, my one that I have, he just has his tail down, and he just does not like what he's doing.
Oh, dear.
And I don't want to bring him back, the rescue dog back, because he's so sweet other than that. And it's just play biting. I just wonder what I could do to stop that.
So let me ask you more information. I wish I could, like, quick, send the video.
Yeah.
I wish I could see it. So be a videotape for me. So when you, you know, so the two dogs start playing. So tell me what you're seeing. Tell me exactly what's happening. Be a videotape for all of us, okay?
Okay, well, when he first came, he's really friendly. He's like a little over a year, so he's very playful. Got lots of energy. He runs up to him, play bite, you know, like little nick bite, 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 and just runs and grabs his tail and, you know, punches his butt, just sniffs him everywhere. He just doesn't stop. And then
okay.
Diesel will just kind of pull away because he doesn't like it. Because, like I said, he's been bit before, so I think he's afraid he's going to get hurt.
Well, and he is getting hurt. And, you know, yeah. I mean, you know, that's, yeah. So your new dog is a cute, charming bully.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
Right?
He's playing. It's his way of playing.
Yeah. I bet. And so there's, you know the kids on the playground who played too rough, right? So what we don't know is did your new dog ever learn how to play correctly or not? Because he's not playing appropriately. This is rude. I mean, your dog has every reason to be cowered by this other dog. He really is. I know it looks playful and sweet and cute, but it really is bully behavior in that, I mean, I...
Yeah.
I don't want to project too much, but I mean, I remember, don't you remember being on a playground and having somebody like, you know, there's this guy, Ronnie Wild. Ronnie Wild used to play really rough with me and pick me up and throw me around. And it was like, I'm just playing. Play is defined as two individuals mutually engaging. And there's something called self-handicapping in play. So anybody who knows how to play correctly knows how to self-handicap. So basically, you're in a dance, you know, and if you're stronger and faster than the other individual, you damp yourself down. You know, watch some big, strong guy play with his one-year-old kid, right? You know, that's the ultimate in self-handicapping. All this incredible power, and they use a hundredth of it, right? So they don't want to, you know, because they want to make it fun for everybody. So your question is, how do you deal with this? First of all, your first loyalty is to was it Diesel, did you say?
Yeah, Diesel.
Diesel.
Yeah.
Your first loyalty, obviously, is to Diesel, right? And so Diesel needs to know you have his back. So one of the things I would do is I would manage that. I would keep them away from each other for, you know, good periods of time. So the new dog is in a crate or a back room somewhere, and you've got Diesel out, and he's relaxing with you, and life is the way it used to be. Then I would manage the play sessions so that if the other dog sort of like runs up to Diesel and jumps on him, I would, and this may or may not work, it only works on some sort of very sensitive kind of dogs, but if I was there, and what's the new dog's name?
Sebastian.
So if I was there and Sebastian ran over to Diesel and sort of jumped on top of him and bit his tail, I would yelp for Diesel. I would literally go, ah! And I would get in between the two of them, and I would back Sebastian away and look at him and say, what did you do? What? And sometimes you can teach dogs to learn to sort of damp down that kind of exuberance.
And we'll take a quick look at the news and weather, and then we'll be back with Patricia. Stay with us. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're taking a look at resiliency and our dogs, and Patricia McConnell with us, certified applied animal behaviorist, international speaker, author, and 10 guides in training and behavioral problems. Her books include The Other End of the Leash, For the Love of a Dog, and The Education of Will, a mutual memoir of a woman and her dog. And that latest book, The Education of Will, was out in hardcover a while back. Now it's just out in softcover. So you can join in with your own questions, comments, or maybe experiences at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. And we had Kelly from Mineral Point on, Patricia, when we broke for news, talking about play biting and her...
And her new dog, yeah. And, yeah, thanks for hanging in there, Kelly. And what I wanted to add is that play behavior is one of those behaviors that sometimes you can change and turn around, and sort of sometimes it's really hard to turn around. So one thing I would suggest is, first of all, being sure to protect Diesel, as I was saying. So lots of times where the dogs are separated, and if you have to spend some time training Sebastian to be fine in a crate, you know, there you go. That's fine. He needs, you know, it's a good thing to have any dog trained to anyway. You can have gates up in between. Little kid gates is a great way to keep dogs separate for a while so that Diesel feels protected. And then you can manage their play a little better because you can't always be on either. I mean, let's face it, you know. So when they're playing, I would very much... do everything you could to intervene if Sebastian is a little bitey. Again, try yelping, which Diesel's not doing. And one of the things Larry and I were talking about during the break is that very often it's the dog who will train another dog to be more polite. So, you know, it'll get an appropriate correction from another dog who's the receiver of this play nip. And it's like, yo, wow, do not do that to me anymore, right? And it'll get a growl or maybe a muzzle nip or, you know, a little snap back or something, which is totally appropriate. So this dog may never have gotten it from another dog. Diesel, regrettably, is not going to be able to do it. Another thing, if you had somebody that you really trusted, if you had a local really great progressive trainer, you might watch him play with other dogs, Sebastian, play with other dogs, see if there was another adult dog who would give an appropriate correction. But I worry that that could turn into a fight. So yeah. I would only do that with a lot of caution, a lot of professional expertise, and a lot of care. So, yeah. But good luck. Your dog is young enough that possibly you can turn this around.
Good luck. Thank you so much for calling, Kelly. I want to give Mark in Monroe a chance to join us. Mark, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, you're talking about post-traumatic stress, and I have an Australian Kelpie. I walk out to our local sportsman's club land, and I introduced him to the land several years ago. Really fine with it. One time I was out there, and there's also a shooting range there, and this dog is gun shy. And, you know, he ran right back to the truck, and he said, "We're out of here." And I respected that and took him home and took him to someplace where he felt safe. And now I can take him out there when nobody is out there at all. And he still, I'll try to walk him away from the vehicle back onto the trail system. And he'll lay down or he'll, you know, try to pull me back to the vehicle.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to figure out how I can get him to back to enjoy that spot because it's a safe situation. It's fenced from other properties.
Oh,
and
yeah. Things
that my biggest problem is when he runs back to the vehicle, there's an open road to the highway.
Sure, of course.
And he ran out on the highway once.
Oh.
And I was like, okay, well, I'm just going to find myself a dead dog. I don't really want to do that anymore.
Oh, terrifying. Yeah. Oh, and I so hear you. There's so few places we can walk our dogs. You know, which are great areas to give dogs autonomy and give them exercise and give them this wonderful experience. So I feel your pain. I want you to be able to walk your dog there, too. So here are a couple things you can try. I have nothing that's gonna like I've got no magic for you, but a couple things you can try are, first of all, you can do some conditioning. So does he start to get nervous as you drive towards this area? When do you first see he's nervous as you're approaching this area?
When I get out of the vehicle with him.
Okay.
He's pulling the parking lot. He knows where he's at. He's excited about being there.
Okay.
But like if I get him out of the vehicle and he looks back towards the range, and if there's a vehicle parked down there or someone else over there, and I've actually walked him down to the range when there's nobody down there.
Mm-hmm.
Say, hey, look, there's nobody here. There's nothing to be scared of.
Okay.
Let's go someplace else.
Okay, so that's very useful information because that gives me an idea of where to start this conditioning. So you're going to do counter-classical conditioning, like Pavlov taught dogs inadvertently to drool when they heard the sound of the door open, right? So you're going to do sort of the opposite, is you're going to train a different response to this area than what he has now. So I would take his favorite food, and, you know, the best thing you can do literally, you know, is go, you know, go for the big stuff. I mean, cut up some beef, you know, cut up some chicken, cut up some real meat into hunks big enough for him to really get that he's got a piece of meat in his mouth, but not massive quantities, so you're going to make him sick because you're going to give him a lot of it, okay? So you're going to drive to this place. You're going to park. You're going to feed him some of this food, and you're going to drive away, literally. Then you're going to, so this is how much time do you have? Are you retired? Can you spend, you know, hours doing this? So ideally you will spend a lot of time doing this. So then the next time you drive back, you get out of the vehicle, you drop some chicken on the ground, you hand him some beef, you get back in the car, you drive away. So you see what I'm building on? What you're doing is you're going to gradually start reintroducing him to this area in tiny little incremental steps that are associated with something absolutely wonderful. Now, if he likes play better, if he likes to play ball better, play ball. That's more effective than food if you have a dog who's driven to play ball. Does he like ball by any chance?
Yeah, that's the thing. He has no concept of a ball, frisbee, or anything.
Right.
For a herding dog, it's just, you know, unusual.
It's like, yeah. What is that thing? I'm not even paying attention to it. It's not alive. Yeah, okay. So use food. And so the third time you're going to drive up, you're going to, and I would have him on a really long line, by the way. Because you just can't take that risk, right? If once you progress farther, he gets away from you and he runs back. So you're going to have him on a really long line. You're going to walk 10 steps towards where you normally go. You're going to give him chicken. And then you're literally going to go like, oh, too bad. No more. We have to leave now. And what you want is him to leave when he's like, no, I don't want to go. I want more chicken. So be sure as you're walking away and going back to the car, nothing good happens. You very ostensibly take the food away. It's like, all done, all gone, too bad. Oh, we have to go. And so you're going to use his responses to let you know how far and how fast to go. I will tell you generically, most people go too far and too fast. So when you think you can progress, don't. Do 10 feet away from the car twice or three times, and then go 30 feet away from the car. So just go very slowly, and very often you can bring a dog like this back. But Kelpies and Border Collies, I regret to say, are super sound sensitive, probably because they were bred to listen to us when they're working 500 yards away from us, right? They're super sound sensitive. So it's a big problem in these kind of herding dogs. But good luck. It's possible you can get your walks back.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, let's go to Jack in Madison next. Jack, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, thanks for taking me. So I've got three dogs, and one of mine, if you can try to wrap your head around it, is half miniature wiener dog, half black lab.
So oh, my goodness.
I cannot. I am not capable of wrapping my head around that.
Wow.
Looking at her, she has every feature color. She looks just like a black lab, but she's only about a foot off the ground. She's very short and a little bit elongated.
So okay. Like all right. Car. I love the image. Okay.
Yes. But she's got lots of interesting personality traits between those two dogs. But one of them is she's a little bit of a scaredy cat sometimes.
Okay.
And the main one is whenever we get ready to go on a walk and we take out her leash and we use a chest harness for her.
Okay.
She will literally hide from us and be very afraid of putting on her harness. You know, she'll hide under a blanket or wherever else or go upstairs. Once the harness is on, then she's okay. Now we're going on a walk and now she's excited about that. She loves going on walks. But just trying to get that harness on her, you'd think that we were, you know, at the vet
torturing
giving her a shot. She just gives you the saddest look in the world. Like, I can't believe you put this on me type of a thing. So just trying to make her more excited about that.
Yeah. And I can tell you how to do that, but my mind is stuck on why. But that's not going to help you any. So I'll force my mind off of this why question onto now what. You know, I don't know if you heard the last call, but I was talking about counter conditioning.
Yeah.
And I know I talk about this a lot. But the fact is, it's really effective for so many things, especially fear-related problems. So, you know, here we have a dog who's afraid of an area where there were gunshots. Now we have a dog who's afraid, for some reason, I'm dying to figure out, of the harness. Oh, can I come to a house call? Because I'm just dying to see what's going on with this dog. So I would first try some treats. Let me back you up. When you first got the harness, did you just sort of put it on her and then take her out, or did you ease her into it?
I mean, we started her on a leash collar, and then
was she okay with that?
Collar, didn't love it, and it's kind of been always thing since she was a puppy. When I started walking her, we got her as, you know, a puppy. We've been the first one to put a leash on her. So there was nothing in our history that we can think of that would ever initiate this fear. We don't know. We almost thought maybe it's an embarrassment that she doesn't like how she looks in it type of thing. Just that sad look.
I think that's adorably sweet and cute, but wrong. But I love that you thought that. But that's probably not it. Dogs don't worry about bad hair days, thank heavens. The obvious, the sort of quick thing to do, the quick and dirty thing, is to pair the harness with something she loves. So whether it's play or food, you're going to do the same kind of step-by-step counter conditioning I talked about with a dog who was afraid of the area where the gunshots were. So it's you pick up a harness and you give her a piece of some wonderful piece of food. Then you put the harness down, then you pick it up, then you give her a piece of treat. I would leave the harness lying around, for one thing. You know what I do? I would put it on cue. I would use operant conditioning. Okay, here's what I do. I would put the harness, I would put the harness on the floor, and every time she went anywhere near it, I would say, good, and I would give her a treat. So you're going to have to define near it. Watch her, you know, and if she, like, walks around it and avoids it, but then one time she walks 2 feet closer to it, I would say, good, and I would give her a treat. As she gets closer and closer, I'd say, good, and I'd give her a treat. I'd smear some food on it so she wants to sniff it, and when she sniffs it, I'd say, good, and give her a treat. Then I'd start saying, where's your harness? Where's your harness? And if she just looks at it, good, give her a treat. Where's your harness? Good, give her a treat. Where's your harness? She walks one step towards it. Good, give her a treat. Then you pick up the harness and hold it, and you say, where's your harness? And if she if she even leans towards it, you say, good, and give her a treat. If she has a setback, then you just go backwards, okay? So I would literally put it on cue. I would teach her, where's your harness? There's something about having it put on. I'm guessing that it's not the device itself. It's something about the way it's put on. So that's why I want to do a house call. But I can't sort that out on the radio. So try this method. Or bring the dog to the studio next time I'm on, and we'll do it here, because I'm dying to meet your dog.
Oh,
good luck.
Sounds like good luck. Thank you so much for calling, Jack. Love to hear how that turns out. Let's go to Sandra in Mount Pleasant next. Hi, Sandra.
Oh, hi. My original question was answered, but we have a new baby in the family, not in our house, but we visit the house once a month. The baby's 3 months old, at once a month or more.
Okay.
Our dog, who doesn't urinate in our house, wanted to urinate in the baby's room on things twice.
Okay.
So, I kept him at the door and said no when I was in there with the baby. And then I would just close the door and not let him in. So are there some better ways to get him to not do that?
So your concern is the house is urinating in the baby room, right?
Yeah,
there are. There are. And that can be an expression of discomfort, sort of a need to... put his scent down to mark territory. But, you know, a lot of people don't think about how much that's also a way of familiar, surrounding yourself with familiar scent. It's like when you go to a motel room and you take your stuff out, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, this is my stuff. This is my room now, right? So it's not just about territory the way we think about it with wild animals. I think it's as much about being familiar. So, yeah, there are a couple things you could do. One is be sure you've eliminated that scent. Be sure to use commercial products wherever the dog went before, because once it smells like the slightest tiny bit of urine, it's going to be like a toilet seat. It's going to be like, well, that's where I'm supposed to go. So be sure you're doing that kind of cleanup maintenance. And I would take the dog in, since this is, you're not going to be there that often, you know, this is not your home, I would take the dog in on a leash. And you're right there. I would give it some treats. I would say, where's the baby? I'd have somebody holding the baby. Very cautious with newborns and dogs, by the way. Please, please, please. Somebody holding the baby. Where's the baby? Good dog. Good dog. And get the dog spending more time in there, but while being managed, okay?
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing wrong. I just want to say, one thing professional animal trainers do way more often than people who aren't professionals, is we manage things. We don't feel like we have to train everything. So there is nothing wrong with basically having your dog learn to go somewhere else in the house. So rather than worrying at the door and like he's trying to get in the door and I'm trying to slide in, you know, and manage him at the door, teach him what you do want him to do. Go in your room, you know, go in your room. Teach him to go in his own room. Teach him to go in a crate. Teach him to go somewhere where he's comfortable, he's safe, and he's out of the way. And then you can totally enjoy, you know, the experience. There's nothing wrong with management, not at all.
Oh, there you go. Thank you, Sandra, for calling. And Michelle in Blue Mounds, your turn. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I have 5 and 6-year-old border collies that are really pretty well behaved, and Patricia, you've actually met them briefly.
Oh, good.
But Pippa and Moon Pie, and I just also now have 18 baby chicks that are about a week old.
Ooh.
Is it impossible for me to think that I can imprint these chicks on the dogs? And they have two different reactions. Moon Pie is like really relaxed. He's kind of indifferent. He looks in the little round pen that they're in the bedroom. And Pippa just latches on. It reminds me of what you said about the dog with the glassy eyes just before it's like 2-year-old. And she hasn't struck, but she's like super intense and just follows them with her eyes.
Yeah.
And I think she's a little freaked out that they don't stare back at her and they don't seem to be afraid of her. But is there a way in which I can, I don't know. What can I hope for?
Yeah, gotcha. No, this is a great question. It's actually a bunch of questions. And so yeah, and you know, you see that one of my border collies treats a cat in the house like some strange, unhoofed, small livestock animal. And looks very nervous. A Willie is very nervous about, like, what is it doing in here? And Maggie literally protects it. She acts like it's her puppy. She literally protects it. So, yeah, so you can get this huge range of responses. So first of all, I think it's probably too late to imprint the chicks on the border collies. I don't think you want to do that because you're going to have them basically, they would be imprinted on the dogs. The dogs are too old to imprint, right? So you don't want chickens who think that the dog who wants to herd them or eat them is their mother, right? So I think the best thing to do is you're going to have to manage, I think it's, you said, Pippa, who's looking like she's stalking them, basically. She looks like a border collie herding sheep. You're going to have to manage her. And basically what I would do is I would put some stuff on cue. So I would say, those are the chickens. And then as soon as she looks at them, I would teach her to turn and look at me and watch, and then go do something with her. Go play ball. Go play with a toy. Go play a tug game with her. Give her a treat. I think play would be better than food in this case. But basically teach her every time she looks at them to turn away and look at you. And then you're going to do something fun with her to try and get rid of that tension. So if you can start right away, I think your chances are good. But there is a very, very strong desire in some border collies to herd anything. And they define anything very broadly. So
there you go. Thank you so much for calling. I was thinking about being at Vilas Park. I was there many, many times, the zoo and the lions. The two lions are just there languid, languishing a little bit, it seemed like. And then
a duck?
A guy, it was a special day, and there was a guy on stilts who was sort of had a bird costume. And those two animals, as he walked by, went into
totally went. I love it.
It was, and they just followed along the along the fence, and it was like, whoa!
It is. It is. You can feel that intensity, can't you?
Oh yeah, for sure.
It is really something. If you've never seen it, it's really powerful.
Well, you have some powerful events coming up, as a matter of fact, in Oshkosh, I believe, in May.
Oh, there's lots of stuff going on. I'm leaving to speak in Philadelphia at this Working Dog Conference about resilience, which will be really fun. I'm speaking at the Lakefly Writers Conference about how being a dog trainer can make you a better writer, how being a writer can make you a better dog trainer. It's going to be really, really fun. That's really fun. And I've designated the year 2018 of the Year of Libraries. So I'm speaking at libraries all over Wisconsin. I just spoke in Lake Geneva. I'm going to speak in Mercer in Mercer up in northern Wisconsin, Virginia, Minnesota, Marshall, Marshfield, Prairie du Sac, Mount Horeb. I've skipped some already. Anyway, I love libraries, and I can't wait to help support them.
And May 12th, you've got a book signing in Oshkosh at the Premier Waterfront Hotel and Convention Center.
That's right. Hope to see you there.
Well, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much, Patricia. You'll come back again,
I hope. Yes. I'd love to.
Patricia McConnell, her latest book is called The Education of Will, just out in paperback, the subtitle, A Mutual Memoir of a Woman and Her Dog. She'll be back. We'll talk with her again. Tomorrow, Phil Pelletieri joins us to talk about the world of insects. In the meantime, stay with us.